headlines this hour. Muslim pilgrims converge in large numbers on the Iraqi city of Karbala to mark Arba'in, the 40th day after the martyrdom anniversary of Imam Hussein. Iran rejects claims by the Israeli Prime Minister against the Islamic Republic's nuclear program. Also in the headlines, an explosion hits a residential building in the Swedish city of Gothenburg, leaving at least 25 people wounded. Thanks for joining us. Crowds of Muslim pilgrims are in the Iraqi holy city of Karbala to commemorate the Day of Arba'in. The annual occasion is one of the world's biggest religious gatherings. It marks the 40th day after the martyrdom anniversary of Imam Hussein, the grandson of the Prophet Muhammad. Pilgrims, most of them Iraqis, have walked to Karbala, where Imam Hussein is buried. Security is beefed up in and around the city. Prior to the pandemic, the event drew millions each year. But now the Iraqi government has restricted the number of foreign pilgrims to several 10,000s. Imam Hussein and dozens of his companions were martyred during the Battle of Karbala with a tyrant of their time over 13 centuries ago. They were killed on the day of Ashura.
Muslims marked Arba'in, the 40th day that followed the anniversary of the martyrdom of Imam Hussein, peace be upon him, the third Shia Imam and his 72 strong companions in the Battle of Karbala in what is now southern Iraq in 680 AD. Each year, millions of Muslim mourners set out on a symbolic 80-kilometer-long walk that begins from the holy city of Najaf in Iraq, where Imam Hussein's father Imam Ali's shrine is located, to the holy city of Karbala that houses Imam Hussein's shrine. But this year, due to COVID-19 pandemic, Iraq has imposed restrictions on the number of pilgrims. According to Iranian officials, nearly 60,000 Iranian pilgrims have traveled to Iraq to partake in the huge annual Arba'in procession. The Arba'in march is of great significance for Muslims. In Iran, those who cannot make it to Karbala take part in a symbolic march from Tehran to the town of Ray towards the holy shrine of Hazrat Abdulazim Hassani.
Arba'in march is one of the largest religious gatherings in the world, which manifests the extent of the age-old love for Imam Hussein and his ideology of resistance against injustice. This year, although the COVID-19 pandemic has either cancelled or restricted most of the mourning processions, our love for Imam Hussein runs deep in our hearts and will never fade away.
The love for Imam Hussein runs in our family. My family and I always take part in such religious ceremonies to remember Imam Hussein, because with his sacrifice, he saved the true Islam. Still after 14 centuries, we honor him as a savior of our religion, and he's the best role model for me and my children.
Over the past decade, the Iranian and Iraqi people have begun participating in what came to be known as the Great Walk of Arba'in, a procession during which millions of Iranian and Iraqi Shias travel on foot to the shrine city of Karbala, south of Iraq, to renew allegiance with the ideals and teachings of Imam Hussein, peace be upon him. The Battle of Karbala featured an unjust fight between Imam Hussein and his army and the hugely outnumbered army of the Umayyad Caliph of the time, Yazid.
The Day of Arba'in is a day on which the family members of Imam Hussein return to the plain of Karbala to properly bid farewell to their fallen heroes and finally grieve for their loved ones. Saman Kujuri, Tehran.
Members of the Islamic movement in Nigeria marched for several kilometers along a major road to mark the Arba'in, which comes up 40 days after the Ashura. The Arba'in is a symbolic trek observed at the end of the 40 days mourning period of the martyrdom of Imam Hussein, the grandson of the Prophet of Islam. The Islamic movement in Nigeria says the mourning has become a rallying social call for equity in the society.
Imam Hussein is a symbol to justice, and he's decided to sacrifice his life for the sake of justice. So his call is for all humanity, not only the Muslims, because everybody needs justice and everybody hates injustice.
Hundreds of members of the Islamic movement march for a long distance in the hot tropical sun, wearing black and beating their chests as part of the mourning of Imam Hussein. The Arba'in pilgrimage to Karbala in present-day Iraq took place as far back as 61 after Hijra, and members of the Islamic movement still perform this annual ritual with zeal.
We still have to trek a distance now to suffer the way the family of the Prophet suffered, to suffer the way Imam Hussein has suffered, to feel in our body, both in our body and in our spirit, physically, mentally, morally, though we know he was never shaken entirely, this is something he was ready for.
Members of the Islamic movement in Nigeria here said they've not had the opportunity of traveling to the city of Karbala for pilgrimage to the Imam Hussein Holy Shrine, but they've peacefully and successfully conducted this symbolic trek in fulfillment of this religious event. Danjuma Abdullahi, Suleja.
Islamic scholar and researcher Abulfaz Sajidi says the message of Arba'in is that Imam Hussein and his companions were martyred to save man from deviating from the path of God.
At the present time, we see there are various cognitive barriers that can lead society to deviation from Allah's way. The mass media, and there are many other factors that they try to expand these doubt, these ignorance all over the world. So the message from Arba'in is that we take exactly into consideration these main obstacles for human guidance at the present time. Unfortunately, mass media, satellites, virtual networks, all of them, they are expanding this confusion, this doubt about Islam, about the way of Allah, about Imam Hussein, about everything, about applying God's teaching for life.
Iran has lashed out at Israel after its Prime Minister Naftali Bennett accused the Islamic Republic of crossing what he called red lines in its nuclear program. In a tweet, Iran's ambassador to the UN, Majid Takht-e Ravanchi, said that Israel is in no position to discuss its, quote, peaceful nuclear program when it has hundreds of nuclear warheads. Takht-e Ravanchi added that Bennett's speech was full of lies. During his UN General Assembly speech, Bennett vowed that Israel would not allow Tehran to acquire a nuclear weapon. He also urged a more concrete international effort to halt Iran's nuclear activities. His comments come as Tehran has time and again reiterated that its nuclear program is merely for peaceful purposes. Investigative journalist Tani Gwaslin believes that there is nothing illegal about Iran's nuclear program and that Israel had better be worried about its own.
Well, I think with the nuclear conflict that's going on in the Middle East, particularly between Iran and Israel, actually, there is actually nothing illegal or nothing contentious about the Iranians developing nuclear power. And we're constantly getting smears from the Israeli side saying, oh, actually, really what the Iranians want is nuclear weapons. Now, anyone that studies this knows that actually a fatwa was issued against nuclear weapons on moral grounds in Iran, about against their manufacture. And I think that's a perfectly reasonable thing. I mean, for us as peace campaigners here in Britain, ever since the 1950s and 60s, we have been against nuclear weapons on moral grounds. And it's great to see the Iranians actually going along with that. Now, the same is not true, I'm afraid, in Israel. Although in the Old Testament it says, thou shalt not kill, I mean, we realise that the nuclear bombs will kill, if they're used in anger, tens of thousands, possibly even hundreds of thousands of innocent people. And so I think the Israelis also should consider, through their faith, the idea that maybe this is not a good idea to pursue these weapons. As we know, the Israelis have, they believe anyway, something like 200 nuclear weapons. And anyway, even if the Iranians did have nuclear weapons, this was proved in the Cold War to be actually quite a good thing to keep the balance of power, to stop a nuclear-armed country attacking a non-nuclear-armed country.
Tehran has dismissed as biased and false a claim by the International Atomic Energy Agency that it was barred from a nuclear site in Iran. The spokesman for the Atomic Energy Organization of Iran, Behruz Kamalvandi, also warned the IEA against disrupting the cooperation with the Islamic Republic. On Sunday, the agency said that its inspectors had been denied access to a centrifuge manufacturing site in the city of Karaj near the capital, Tehran. Iran says the facility is exempt from an understanding that was reached with the IAEA earlier this month over servicing, monitoring, and surveillance equipment at Iranian nuclear sites. Russia also says denying the agency access to the site does not violate safeguards agreements. Iranian officials say the Karaj site was sabotaged in an attack in June, which is still being investigated by security and judicial authorities. An explosion has hit a residential building in the Swedish city of Gothenburg, sending at least 20 people to the hospital. Some reports have put the number at 25, including three women injured seriously. The explosion hit the building early on Tuesday. Gothenburg's emergency services says that their teams are still working to put out fires in the building. They say several apartments and stairwells have been affected. The emergency services says that several hundred people have already been evacuated. The rest are being evacuated also. Swedish police say an investigation is underway to find the cause of the blast. The French President Emmanuel Macron has been hit with an egg while visiting an international food trade fair in the southern city of Lyon. Macron was walking through the crowd when a man threw the boiled egg at him. The young protester was heard shouting, "Long live the revolution!" The French president's bodyguards later arrested the protester. In June, Macron was slapped in the face by a critic during a visit to southeastern France. That man was also arrested and sentenced to 4 months in prison. British authorities have put the military on standby to help deal with the ongoing fuel crisis, as fear over tanker driver shortages has led to panic buying. In a statement, the Energy Ministry's Department for Business said that limited number of military tanker drivers are in a state of readiness and will be deployed, if necessary, to further stabilize fuel supply chain. This, as a shortage of tanker drivers has left many of the country's pumps dry. The shortage is due to new Brexit visa regulations as well as a COVID backlog.
British government considering sending in army personnel in an effort to alleviate the fuel crisis that has seen back-to-back queues or empty forecourts across the UK over the past days. Drivers across the capital especially have been involved in a desperate game of trying to beat their neighbour to a petrol station that was still lucky enough to have some fuel left.
I basically just ran out of fuel and but I've been trying several of them, and then everyone just been shutting down. So it's quite bad, really. You know, I mean, I never thought, you know, I mean, we're going to run out of fuel. I thought maybe one day we're going to run out of food, but not of fuel.
This morning, we are supposed to have a delivery, because due to shortage of drivers, we couldn't get a delivery. It has been postponed till tonight now. To be honest with you, since the Brexit, this thing has happened, like, you know. A lot of drivers have gone back home, like, and hence, there is a sort of shortage in the haulage industry.
It's empty forecourts like these that will no doubt be causing political anxiety for the government. But none will be more stressed than the British consumer, who might be wondering where might they get the next full tank in order to make it to school, to make it to work, to make it through the day. The Transport Secretary, Grant Shapps, is keen to describe this not as a crisis exacerbated by Brexit, but one manufactured by the haulier industry, who says they need over 100,000 extra drivers to meet current need. There's also been a degree of blame placed at the feet of the consumers for panic buying and driving up demand unnecessarily.
There's no shortage of the fuel within the country, so the most important thing is actually that if people carry on as they normally would and fill up their cars when they normally would, then you won't have queues and you won't have shortages at the pump either.
Prime Minister Boris Johnson has already announced a three-month visa scheme to tempt experienced EU HGV drivers back to the UK to assist until Christmas, and the role the army could play is also being explored.
We are bringing MOD trainers in to accelerate some of the HGV training. We've to clear a backlog of people who want to carry out those tests, so there's definitely a role there for the MOD.
In the meantime, consumers want to guarantee that they are not left stranded. And if that means driving miles in search of the precious fuel, it's a journey they're willing to make. Amina Taylor, London.
The U.S. federal government is facing a partial shutdown as the Senate has failed to pass an emergency spending bill. $3.5 trillion bill received 50 no votes after Republicans refused to increase a limit on federal debt. It needed at least 60 votes to be approved in the 100-seat Senate. Democrats say that they will try again before Thursday's deadline to push the measure ahead. That is when current funding to keep the U.S. government operating expires. A shutdown could lead to unpaid leaves for hundreds of thousands of federal employees and a halt to many government functions. Thousands of healthcare workers are expected to be fired in the U.S. state of New York for not complying with the COVID-19 vaccine mandate, taking effect on Monday. New York hospitals are postponing non-necessary surgeries to boost their vaccination rates. However, health centers in areas with lower vaccinations are facing a shortage of staff. The state issued an order last month mandating that all healthcare workers receive at least one dose of the vaccine by September 27th. Push came amid a rise in the number of daily infections and fatalities in the U.S. Authorities blamed the hike on the outbreak of the highly infectious Delta variant of the coronavirus. North Korea's ambassador to the U.N. has called on the United States to give up its hostile stance toward his country. Kim Song added no one could deny his country's right to self-defense and weapon tests. He made the remarks on the last day of the U.N. General Assembly, shortly after the South Korean military said the North had fired an unidentified projectile into its eastern waters. Kim demanded that the U.S. permanently stop its joint military drills with South Korea. Pyongyang has long accused Washington and Seoul of pursuing a hostile policy. Talks aimed at dismantling the North's nuclear and ballistic missile programs, in return for U.S. sanctions relief, collapsed in 2019. And that is for this edition of World News. This is bye-bye for now.
Diverse range of programs. Spirituality. Youth. Eastern Tales. Roundtable discussions. Culture. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
ایمان را در خودتون تقویت بکنید، ایمانی که هم در اینجا شما را شرافتمند می کند و هم در پیشگاه حق آبرو دارید و با آبرومندی وارد می شید به حق تعالی.
In the path of the Imam.
Dear listeners, we're going to continue our discussion of the founder of the Islamic Republic of Iran, Imam Khomeini's testament. In today's program, we're going to discuss another part of the Imam's testament, where he exposes the enemy's plots for forging rift between universities and seminaries. Please stay with us. Seminaries have a long history in Iran, while modern universities are considered new institutions, although the older form of academic education dates back to over 1,000 years in Iran. This is proved by the Jundi Shapur University in Khuzestan province, which dates back to the Sassanid era. The first modern university was founded in Iran in 1934, and by the name of Tehran University. However, seminaries date back to the first Islamic centuries. Seminaries have shouldered the responsibility of educating Iranian teenagers and young people before the entry of university to the country. As a result of Western propaganda, seminaries are considered as a center of religious teaching with no link to rationality and rational education. But with the entry of faithful and devoted students into universities in the 1950s, gradually there emerged congruity and convergence between these two educational institutions. Alongside the formation and reinforcement of the despotic climate in the country and further assistance between university and seminary students, the political ruling system was more and more criticized by both centers. Imam Khomeini's high emphasis on necessity of cooperation between universities and seminaries broke the negative mentality among the members of the two centers and society at large. Furthermore, the presentation of new political and revolutionary ideas by him strengthened his base among academics. Imam Khomeini, may God bless his soul, believed that unity between universities and seminaries would lead to the victory of the Islamic Revolution. After the triumph of the Islamic Revolution too, he considered this cooperation and unity very effective for the growth and bolstering of the Islamic Republic system of government. In view of this, he wrote in his testament, "Among the devilish schemes of the big colonial and imperial powers or exploitative powers that have been implemented for many years and has reached its climax since the era of Reza Khan and pursued by Muhammad Reza I, different ways is to isolate the clergy. In the era of Reza Khan, it was pursued through pressure, through suppression, defrocking, imprisonment, exile, disrespect, execution, and so on. And in the era of Muhammad Reza, it was pursued by scheme and other ways, one of which was forging hostility between academic and clergyman, which with propaganda was carried out in this field. Unfortunately, due to the unawareness of both strata about this devilish plot of superpowers, it yielded greatly. On the one hand, from schools to universities, it was tried to appoint the teachers, professors, and university chancellors from among Western educated individuals, and those who were deviated from Islam and belonged to other religions, and the committed faithful were placed in a minority in order to train the effective stratum, which would take the rule in future, from childhood to adolescence up to youth, in a way that would hate religion in general and Islam in particular, and that they would hate clergymen. And at the same time, these were introduced by Britain and later on by the advocates of capitalism and feudalists and supporters of backwardness and opponents of civilization and sublimity. On the other hand, this wicked propaganda, they would frighten clergymen, promoters and devotees of universities and academics, and would accuse them of not respecting religion, promiscuity and opposition to the symbols of Islam and religion. Imam Khomeini, may God bless his soul, further wrote in his testament, "The result of those policies is that politicians and statesmen were opposed to religion, Islam and clergymen, and the faithful. Whereas, the masses of people who liked religion and clergymen were opposed to the government and the ruling system and whatever belonged to it. And the deep differences between the government and nation and academic and clergymen opened the way for looters to the extent that all affairs of the country were in their power and all reserves of the nation were poured into their pockets, so that you saw what happened and what was going to happen to this oppressed nation. Now, with the grace of God and the struggle of the nation, from clergymen to academics and to ordinary people, workers, farmers and other strata of society have torn up the chains of captivity and broken the dam of the power of superpowers, and rescued the country from them and their lackeys. My advice to the present and the future generation is that they should not neglect this history, and that the academics and the courageous young people and clergymen and students of Islamic sciences consolidate the bond of friendship as much as possible between the seminaries and the universities, and never be negligent of the plots and schemes and conspiracies of the deceitful enemy. And as soon as they see a person or persons who try with their words or deeds to sow differences between the seminary and the university, to guide and advise them. And if it is not effective, leave him alone and isolate him so that they do not let the conspiracy to take root."
Now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Hello, welcome to the Spotlight. I'm Kavitak Lee. The Kremlin warned that any expansion of NATO military infrastructure in Ukraine would cross one of President Vladimir Putin's red lines. What are Putin's red lines, especially when it comes to Ukraine? Meanwhile, Belarus has said that it had agreed to take action with Moscow to counter growing NATO activity. In this edition of the Spotlight, we will look at whether Ukraine is brewing to be a flashpoint again between Russia and the U.S., and what Russia will do now that one of its red lines has been crossed.
Russia has warned NATO against setting up military infrastructure in Ukraine. It comes after Belarusian President Alexander Lukashenko said the United States is creating military bases in Ukraine under the guise of establishing training centers. Lukashenko said he has discussed the issue with his Russian counterpart, Vladimir Putin, and they agreed to take action to counter the growing NATO activity.
It's actions that will provide for the strategic interests and security of our two allied states. The issue of potential expansion of NATO military infrastructure in Ukraine was numerously mentioned by President Putin, and President Putin said it was beyond a red line he had talked about repeatedly.
Moscow has time and again warned against NATO's expansion in Ukraine, saying it is a red line the West will regret crossing. Last week, Russia held large-scale joint military drills with Belarus. The maneuvers followed Ukraine's joint war games with the U.S. and other NATO member states. Tensions have been simmering between Moscow and Kiev since the ouster of Ukraine's elected president Viktor Yanukovych in a U.S.-backed revolt in 2014. The tensions further escalated after Crimea declared autonomy from Ukraine to reunite with the Russian Federation. The so-called revolution in Ukraine and Kiev's subsequent reach out to NATO could be part of a puzzle being pieced together by the United States and its allies to contain Russia militarily.
Well, joining us for this edition of the Spotlight, we have Executive Vice President of the Eurasia Center, Earl Rasmussen, who joins us from Minneapolis. Also, radio host and political analyst Tim Kirby, who joins us from Moscow.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
I'd like to welcome you both. Tim Kirby, let me first start with you. You have a warning coming from the Kremlin that any expansion of NATO military infrastructure, as it has been termed, in Ukraine would cross one of Vladimir Putin's red lines. First, what NATO infrastructure is he referring to? I'm sure it's not just a couple guns.
No, what they're referring to is the possibility that essentially, especially the U.S. or NATO as a whole, is trying to preemptively build bases before Ukraine would be to join NATO. However, we should go back a few years in time. The leadership of the breakaway republics out east in the Donbass both claim that whereas NATO says they've offered basically soldiers to train the locals to protect themselves, the breakaway republics consider them to be mercenaries and believe that the concept of this training process has been used to masquerade different operations, especially by mercenaries.
Just to rewind a little bit here, when you say mercenaries, can you expand a little bit more for us on that?
Well, judging by some of the, let's just say, not so fortunate people who have, especially Polish or other Eastern European citizenship, you know, the United States, Poland, Germany, where else have they found people from? Thinking maybe possibly Romania. None of these countries have entered this war on an official capacity, but time and again you happen to find, or at least according to the breakaway republics, you happen to find a dead body with that particular identification on it. So there does seem to be, at least if you believe the breakaway republics' version of history, there does seem to be a mercenary at the very least influence. Perhaps those mercenaries are actually not so much in it for the money, and it's part of something covert. But again, proving that is quite difficult, so we shouldn't jump into conspiracy theories.
Sure. Well, Earl Rasmussen, Vladimir Putin is indicating that this is a red line, but it's plural. Tell us what the red lines of President Putin is. Obviously, as evident from the news, one of them is the fact that Moscow is under the impression that the U.S. is building military bases in Ukraine.
Yeah, I think. Well, I think obviously we know one of those red lines is inclusion of Ukraine into NATO. I personally do not see that happening, although there is a lot of political pressure to it. I don't think the Europeans would be supportive of that as well because they know that would be dangerous. You can talk about the expansion of NATO into Ukraine. You know that's. If you had actual military bases, that definitely would be in that area. I don't necessarily think that. Often we have, training advisors, and you can put those in many different, you know, modes or interpretations of that across the world with many different places. And those definitely are not considered military bases. Now, could they be using that as a means to hide potential increased growth in military presence there? Absolutely. But from a purely training military advisory perspective, I don't necessarily see that as crossing into that red line. Getting close to it, but I don't necessarily see that in that zone area. I think Russia would continue to seek to find a diplomatic solution versus a military solution, and then maybe we'll get into that later. But the issues now and the growth of a presence, or even the military advisory presence and training presence, increases the potential likelihood of perhaps Ukraine doing something on their own, maybe with, you know, some type of approval, but definitely potentially on their own, that may escalate situation.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's try to just break down this piece of news in all its different details here. Tim Kirby, Belarusian president, has warned of a joint response with Russia to this increased activity of NATO in Ukraine. Tell us why Belarus is involved here, and what type of joint response may it be referring to?
Well, why it's involved is because it would seem, according to the Belarusian president, that it wasn't that long ago that they tried to stage a color revolution against him. Because we have to remember that despite the fact that maybe on the surface he seemed very loyal to Moscow, he's been playing a good game of balanced politics his entire career as president. Only recently, when he sort of refused to submit completely to the demands of the West, basically they tried to do the old good old color revolution, and that has sort of forced his hand to shove him closer to Moscow. So essentially, in the past, maybe when the Maidan Revolution happened, when the first shots were fired in the Donbass, Belarus was much more neutral in many ways. In fact, that's why there were the Minsk Accords, because it was sort of in between the West and the East, and theoretically, it was a neutral territory. But now the interest of their secret service is very much focused on Ukraine. Another reason would be that the very same type of people, and in some instances, literally the exact same people who organized and executed the Maidan, were going up to Belarus to enact some sort of color revolution in Minsk. So there's a bit of a personal interest as well.
Okay, so do you agree with that, Earl Rasmussen, in terms of the involvement that Lukashenko has? Go ahead.
Yeah, I completely agree with that analysis. That you've got, I think there was pressure to probably move more over. Lukashenko has been doing the balancing act. And I think basically he was put in a situation, and the West was supportive and if not complicit completely, but they were definitely involved with supporting the demonstrations and potential color revolution in Ukraine, and basically pushed Lukashenko solidly more into alliance in the Russia camp. You know, they always probably favored that, but Lukashenko really was, as was, you know, our other guest mentioned, really trying to straddle and play an independent role and be in the middle there. But this has become now more of a personal issue with him as well. So I agree that with that position there, we're creating the West actually helped create this situation and the closer ties with between Belarus and Russia as well.
Well, when Lukashenko was asked, Tim Kirby, about what kind of response, he said, first, we did agree with President Putin that some kind of measure needs to take place. And when digging deeper, he said, these need to be actions that ensure the security of the two of our states. What do you think he means by that?
I think it goes back to what I was saying, that a lot of the color revolutionaries came up from Kiev to go try to change things in Belarus. In fact, the sort of Belarusian opposition with their white and red flags has a very similar mentality to the Maidan, Kiev sort of forces that won the battle of the streets in 2014. So in a way, it is for him, for Lukashenko, for Belarus as a whole, it is really a matter of national security. But also, when it comes to Russia, there are really only two issues that I think the public is really deeply unsatisfied with in terms of President Putin. Number one were the Social Security or pension reforms, depending on your terminology, which were very, very unpopular, let's say, and the handling of the situation in Ukraine. Ukraine is a very, very deep part of Russian history. Many would argue an inherent part, an inalienable part, and it's sort of like it's a real tragedy. For Russians, it's a real tragedy, and it's a tragedy so big that it actually, in some ways, causes an element of destabilization within the Russian system itself.
You mentioned, Earl Rasmussen, about Ukraine's, I guess, previous, perhaps, inclination to want to join NATO, and how Russia obviously has vehemently opposed that. Tell us why, and this has been said a number of times in the past years, tell us why that is not something that has happened, why it has there not been enough of a motion forward, either from Ukraine or from NATO, perhaps, for Ukraine to join it.
Well, I think, I think the population in Ukraine is against it. I don't think you have maybe marginally for it, but for the most part against it. I think they see them as... And in reality, Ukraine would be used as a ploy, a playground in the middle of between any type of potential conflict. Really, there's no benefit for NATO to expand other than further kind of isolate Russia for some reason. And I don't think it's good. It just is a poor decision on that side. Plus, if you look at the elections in Ukraine over history, you had the color revolution, the orange revolution. Then you had the movement towards, and you had Lukashenko come into office later on. So you really got a political division there. You've got to the east to more favor Russian. To the west, you've got aspects of historically from Poland and Romania and Czech involved there. So there's a whole different, really have a different culture in Ukraine. It's made up of multiple different cultures. I think on a total perspective, most people would not wish there's not a conflict. Most people would not want to be part of NATO. And most would like to have a peaceful, in both from a military perspective and from an economic perspective, relationship with Russia. Ukraine really has a good potential, at least did at one time, being a bridge between that. But unfortunately, that has probably been put off for a long time, if ever, to reestablish itself. But I think that I don't think the popular support would be behind not only the issue with Russia being against it, but I don't think the popular support in Ukraine, and I don't think the other Europeans would be, especially Germany and France, would be very excited about Ukraine's potential inclusion into the formal NATO structure.
Mm-hmm. Well, Tim Kirby, this is where I'd like to find out who's pushing whom into this scenario. And I'm talking in particular about NATO and the U.S. And I'm going to come at you with this fact, that the U.S. spends more on this NATO budget, from what we understand, than all of the rest of the NATO members combined, estimated to be about $730 billion. That's according to the UK Defense Journal. So given that, is the U.S. pushing NATO in its confrontation with Russia using Ukraine, or is NATO acting on its own? Because it seems that the U.S. is the one making decisions here, in one respect.
Well, in terms of NATO, not just related to Russia, but generally, overall, the real moving force behind that is obviously the United States. I mean, if you look at the composition of NATO, maybe you could make an argument that England and France, which are both nuclear-armed and do have some military potential, may matter. But the overwhelming majority members are just absolutely pathetic, and even Donald Trump himself tried to actually force these people to pay up, to pay their 2% of GDP like they promised, because for years they wouldn't. And America was really footing the bill for all of that. So NATO is really an extension of America. Does it serve the interests of Europe, especially Western Europe? That's up to the viewer to decide. That's a bit of an emotional argument there on either side. But yeah, America's the driving force. And one of the key issues written when the Project for New American Century was written was that you cannot allow a new power to rise. And that ties into the somewhat already cliche musings of Zbigniew Brzezinski, who said that Russia will never become a great power or empire, I forget the wording, without having the Ukraine as part of it. So if his prophecy is to be believed, which there's a lot of logic to, Washington definitely does not want Russia to unite with its historic homeland.
Mm-hmm. Earl Rasmussen, you mentioned about the fact that there are some European countries, perhaps we can mention Germany, at least the signals coming from Merkel, that really do want to have a relationship with Russia. Maybe you can tell us what other European countries do want that. But
I would say obviously Germany, and there's, you know, both my contacts in Russia as well as Germany really have pro positive viewpoints of each other, you know, especially within the business community. And I think France, too. I think France would like to have increased business relationships, economic relationships with Russia. I think also if you look at probably Italy, Greece, two other ones, Spain potentially as well. So it really, there is a lot. And they see a lot of potential economic cooperation, which is beneficial to them, and especially in this current environment. And we're looking at increased economic growth. The Germany obviously is potentially, you know, primed to be a major energy hub, thanks to Nord Stream 2, once that's completed and is online. And we've already seen energy shortages. So this is Russia's easy access from both natural resources, but also from a trade and technology market as well. It's a positive win-win situation if we've got improved economic ties between Russia and Germany, France, and other European countries.
Tim Kirby, a certain incident happened recently, and I'm wondering if this is going to actually affect the way that NATO countries can unite or will be united against Russia, because as one headline said, it appears that it's not going to be the case. NATO countries pondering alliance without Washington. Just one of the headlines.
Yeah.
And this came after the debacle, as some say, over that AUKUS incident, that trilateral security pact between Australia, the UK, and the US. Obviously, France very ticked off about that. Are we looking at perhaps fissures there and distance between countries with the US so as to not follow the US lead when it comes to Russia?
Well, in some ways, if it is true that the U.S. is in decline, it's possible to believe that trying to maintain and hold the NATO that keeps the somewhat arguably valueless Western European continental mainland under control might not really actually be that worth it going into the future. This could be the fact that I live in Russia, but there is a great amount of optimism towards this AUKUS move. For a lot of people in Russia, it's a signal that perhaps America and England are going to be more focused on sort of an Anglo-Saxon world rather than trying to dominate the European continent. Because as mentioned by our other colleague earlier, there is a great desire for many in continental Europe to make better business ties, especially with Russia. And the only reason that there aren't as many is simply the artificial need to enforce sanctions over a peninsula that no one cares about outside of Ukraine and Russia.
All right, a final question to you, Earl Rasmussen. Do you see what is happening between Ukraine and Russia going to the next level where there will be a military phase involved?
I would hope not. I think it's dangerous because of the most recent with additional aid and the rhetoric that goes on. I kind of agree with Mr. Peskov that there may be some unintentional, there may be you know, Ukraine may feel emboldened and kind of take it to on their own, thinking they'll be supported to do some type of military settlement rather than fulfilling the Minsk Accords. And that's that would be unfortunate. I think it would create a very, very bad situation. And I would hope the European allies maintain some control on Ukraine from stepping in that direction. But that's a dangerous area, and I would hope it doesn't escalate to that, but it could it potentially could to some degree, but I think Russia would rightfully put a stop to that very quickly if those military actions happen, and could rapidly deploy forces to that. But I would hope we don't get to that direction, and hope the West kind of controls Zelensky and crew.
All right, very well. We're going to have to end it there. Thank you very much. Let me thank our guests, Executive Vice President of Eurasia Center, Earl Rasmussen from Minneapolis. Thank you. And radio host and political analyst Tim Kirby. A pleasure. Spoke to us from Moscow. And that is for this edition of The Spotlight. From Mikhail Vitakway and the team, it's goodbye until next time.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, parstoday.com/en.
Questions and answers on Islamic beliefs.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In the name of Allah, the most compassionate, the most merciful. May Allah's peace and blessings be upon the Holy Prophet of Islam, Muhammad, and his purified progeny. Dear brothers and sisters, all around the world, assalamu alaikum and welcome to Q&A in Islamic beliefs from IRIB English Radio. In this series of shows, we are trying to touch and talk about some, let's say, questions or misunderstandings which are being asked by different questioners about the theological issues and any question regarding the religious concepts. For this, we invite Islamic researchers and scholars from Qom Seminary Schools to help us with the answers. That's why we have invited Sheikh Murtada Karimi to join us in this studio and help us with answer. Sheikh Murtada, assalamu alaikum and welcome to the show.
Wa alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah and thank you for having me.
Thanks for accepting the invitation, Sheikh. The question of the day, or the doubt or the misconception that we are going to focus and talk about is concerning the revolution of Mukhtar, al-Thaqafi, or the uprising of Mukhtar, which happened after the tragedy of Karbala, and he came to actually take the revenge of the martyrs of Karbala from the murderers of Imam al-Hussein and his family and his loyal companions. There are many different actually perspectives or ideas about Mukhtar and his revolution. Some of them are really paradoxical, and let's say the whole story is really controversial. That's why we want the respected researchers and, let's say, guest speakers, namely in this show, Sheikh Murtada Karimi, inshallah, to shed some light over this important piece of history, to see what was the reality of the revolution of Mukhtar. In case he was a sincere person, so why he did not actually give the rulership, and he did not transfer the leadership of the Islamic Ummah to Imam Sajjad alayhi salam? These are the questions that actually are a little bit ambiguous for us, and we need to clear the ambiguity from that piece of history. So if he was a really, let's say, revenger from the Ahlul Bayt and the household of the Holy Prophet, so why he himself took the power till the end of his life? All in all, what is being said in Shia communities about Mukhtar is something positive, and some critics actually look at him negatively. It would be great, Sheikh, if you give us a good, clear, let's say, picture of what Mukhtar did, and about his sincerity, and the idea of the Ahlul Bayt themselves, the Imams after Imam Hussein alayhi salam, on his revolution would be great, Sheikh.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. As you rightly mentioned, the event and the uprising and the personality of Mukhtar ibn Abi Ubayd Thaqafi is one of the complicated ones, and the reason is the fact that we have different narrations about him, about his character, and about his uprising, and in some cases, they are contradicting each other. And the same is true about the viewpoints of the scholars. So yeah. We know that Mukhtar was born in the first year after Hijra, according to some narrations, and finally he was killed or martyred in 67 after Hijra. Now, the first question is that why wasn't he present in the tragedy of Karbala?
Yeah.
We know that, Mukhtar was, he tried to join the army of Imam Hussein alayhi salam. First of all, when Muslim ibn Haqil, he came to the city of Kufa, first Muslim went to the house of Mukhtar, which shows that Mukhtar was one of the great Shias of the time, that Muslim ibn Haqil, the representative of the Imam, chooses his house as the place of his residence. Later, Ubayd ibn Ziyad came to know that Muslim is there, so Muslim went to the house of Hani ibn Urwa. On the day when Muslim ibn Haqil was martyred, again it's been mentioned that Mukhtar tried to help him. But on that very day, Mukhtar went to a region outside the city of Kufa to, collect some supporters. And when he arrived to the city of Kufa, he realized that Muslim and Hani were already martyred. On the day of Ashura, we know that after the martyrdom of Muslim, Ubayd ibn Ziyad wanted to kill him, but then he gave refuge to him because of some reasons, and he was in prison. So the day of Ashura, Mukhtar was in prison in the city of Kufa, and he was not able to go to Karbala and help Imam Hussein alayhi salam. And it's been mentioned that when the captives and the family members of Imam Hussein alayhi salam were taken to Kufa and the court of Ibn Ziyad, when Mukhtar saw the head of Imam Hussein alayhi salam, he cried and he said some words against Ubaydullah ibn Ziyad, and he mourned for Imam Hussein alayhi salam. Later he was, after the tragedy of Karbala, he was released from the prison because his sister, that is Safiya bint Abu Ubaid, she was the wife of Abdullah ibn Umar. So through the mediation of some people, he was released from the prison. Then we have the uprising of Tawabin led by Sulaiman ibn Surat Khulai. We know that Mukhtar did not agree with them because he believed that Sulaiman and those, the main people in this uprising,